CliffCentral.com.
Yes, that's what dead air sounds like, because this show is ridiculous. This show is... we are going to fight. I can feel it.
Who are you going to fight with? I'm not fighting.
I'm not fighting with anyone.
I'm in no fighting
mood. You know where you...
Me, Abba. I'm a man of peace.
Whatever. Sanbonani Noke, welcome to the show. It is Frankie speaking. For the next hour, we're going to be speaking about the issues that should be discussed in the South African space. Of course, Rorisang and myself speaking about what you want to hear, what's been on your mind, but perhaps you're scared to say in the public space. How are you, man? I missed you.
Yeah, man.
You've missed me.
I've missed you.
Not so much. Okay, fair enough. Like, I've missed you, dude. I've missed you a lot. How have you been? Where have you been?
All over.
What does that mean? Give us a
amongst
sense.
Others, Stellenbosch.
Is it? You went there?
I went to Stellenbosch.
You went to the heart.
And I survived.
Barely. I can look at this Louis Vuitton shirt that you're wearing. What are we speaking about today, Rory? What's going on?
So Julius Malema and the EFF have of late been making a lot of noise about what's called the Stellenbosch Mafia. And we thought, well, and they've been saying and implying that the original state capturers, actually, and the ones that we should really be worried about, the likes of Andile Mkhwetama have also said it, that we're focusing on the Guptas who are stealing peanuts, as they say. Meanwhile, you've got the Stellenbosch Mafia, who apparently are the original or the biggest state capturers. So the question today is, frankly speaking, are the Stellenbosch Mafia the original state capturers?
The original state capturers.
Yep.
And should we ask, does the state, that's what we should be asking. Does the Stellenbosch Mafia actually exist? I mean, is that a question that we need to start with?
Well, it's a question that I think is worth exploring, because it is a myth. But what is not a myth is the Afrikaner Broederbond.
Yeah.
That was known to exist. I think it was established in 1918 in South Africa, established by a group of South Africans. How many? About 37 different professionals.
Yeah.
37 Afrikaner professionals, and they essentially were the original state capturers. So it already answers our question. Now, I think even before we jump into the Stellenbosch Mafia, it is worth. So in 1993, the Afrikaner Broederbond rebranded itself and became the Afrikaner Bond, and we have a representative from there, Mr. Jan Bosman from the Afrikaner Bond, just to help us to understand the context. What is the Afrikaner Bond? What was the Afrikaner Broederbond? What is the Stellenbosch Mafia? And what does this all mean? We need to talk to him quickly before he heads into a meeting, and then I think we kick it off.
Okay, let's do it. Good morning to you, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
No, thank you for your time. I know that we did it on a bit of short notice there. Let's just talk a little bit about the transition from the Broederbond into what is now known as a very legitimate organization. What do you guys do?
Well, let's start from the... You said in your introduction that the Broederbond was formed in 1918. That is true. We're almost 100 years old. But the Afrikaner Broederbond was formed, and you will remember, after the second Boer War, that people were in extreme poverty, the Afrikaner people, extreme poverty, poverty, people streamed to the cities, and something had to be done. And when the Broederbond was formed in 1918, it was people in education, ministers, religious ministers, they came together and said, you know, we must do something about the poverty of the Afrikaner. And from that, a few actions followed, of which the main one was the Reddingsdaad Bond and the Reddingsdaad Congress that was in 1930 somewhere. And there they started with the economic upliftment, identified some of the issues where Afrikaners were involved. And people from civil society started with savings and getting people together, getting savings together, started the company, and those companies grew and grew and grew. And from there, I think we started seeing how South Africa prospered with the companies that started, like Iscor, like Genkor. You know, you can mention a couple of these companies that was formed from the actions, but we were only instrumental in the startup and the idea. And from there, it became huge businesses.
Ian, you mentioned companies like Iscor and so on, and those obviously had a strong government tie. So I think it actually goes to the heart of our question. Were the Afrikaner Broederbond the original state capturers?
I wish it was, and we wouldn't have had to rely on our membership fees and so on. Then we would have had shares in all these companies, but it's not. The Broederbond never had shares or involvement in any of the companies. It was all ideas that were created in a think tank that we had, and from there the individuals went and started with those companies. But you know, all of these
were those individuals members of the Afrikaner Broederbond.
Some of them were, some of them weren't. I remember, and I think also in the book of, for instance, Anton Rupert. He approached the Broederbond for selling of his cigarettes, and you know, we encouraged. That's what I heard from history, is that the Broederbond encouraged people to smoke his brand of cigarette, to buy it, and to smoke his. So it was not a very healthy relationship, if you want to put it in that way. But that was how things were done, and also with some of the other companies, we promoted, you know, people to buy shares in what was at that stage Volkskas. To go on, and from Polskas became it later became Absa, and that's how the Broederbond operated.
Ian, is it a fact that every prime minister from 1948 to the end of apartheid in 1994 was a member of the Afrikaner Broederbond?
Yeah, that is correct. But you must remember that the Broederbond was in fact a think tank, not a organization that wanted to capture the state or the national party or any other political party. It was a think tank, and those members came from. But the difference is that our approach was always and still is that we want to make people who are leaders in society, we want to make them members of our organization. We don't make people leaders.
I'm actually really keen to get to Ralph Matecha, who's also in studio. He works for a think tank. I'm keen to ask him later on if he's trying to capture the state, Andrew.
I'm very interested in what you're saying here at the moment. What would you say right now the point of your think tank is? I mean, you talked about it in the past and how it came out of the Boer War and because the Afrikaner nation was in poverty. What is it now? What is the aim of the Broederbond?
We're still an organization that tried to make a difference, not only for Afrikaners, but also for the broader South African society. So we will, for instance, have an issue debated, create a policy document distributed amongst our members. And our members are in towns all over this country, and they take it up with either the local government or the provincial government or national government, whatever the issue may be. And we also, in our interaction with political parties and also government and also the governing party, we have regular discussions, debate issues, put possible solutions on the table and say that we are here to help. We have Afrikaner knowledge that we want to also make available to government. And it's not a very successful relationship at the moment, but we still try to do that, and that's our philosophy.
The think tank that you spoke about, surely that's a network of very powerful, I suppose, Afrikaners and some others that then can utilize that power to make good bargaining decisions.
Yeah, well, that's not something that's flowing from the Afrikaner Bond or the former Broederbond. Where we have people, we have a network of people, and if those people have certain business ideas and so on, that's what they do, and that's what they do best. And we leave them to do whatever they can do, and for the betterment of society, but also for the private economy in this country.
Jan, before we let you go, I know you have to go, but as a think tank, have you by any chance discussed the recent issue around state capture, and particularly assertions by some that say that while we're worried about the Guptas, it's small change compared to the amounts and the influence that the likes of the Afrikaner Broederbond and members of it have had on government previously and benefited from.
That's That's absolute nonsense. And I've also referred, in your introduction, you referred to the Stellenbosch Mafia. I don't think I've ever met the people who apparently belong to the Stellenbosch Mafia. We've never had contact and so on. That's individuals that in their own right, created companies and were very successful in it. It's not something that came from us or that we try to influence or have involvement in. And I think to blame the Afrikaner Bond or even the Afrikaner Broederbond of state capture in the sense that you see it now, that's simply not true. I think what we did was to have in the 30s and 40s, the main purpose was to uplift the Afrikaner economically and then later also politically. And that's where the involvement also became. And that was, I think, the biggest problem that the Afrikaner Broederbond had was the close relationship with the National Party at that stage.
Jan, we really appreciate your time on the show this morning. It's unfortunately too short. I think there's a number of questions that we'd love to ask you. Perhaps we're looking to turn this into a series. Perhaps we can have you on for a longer period of time. And we appreciate your short notice on this.
You are most welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. That was Jan Bosman. He is the head of what's now known as the Afrikaner Bond, and that obviously came out of the Afrikaner Broederbond. Broederbond means brotherhood, basically, in Afrikaans. For people like me who don't speak the language, you'd have to Wikipedia that.
But it's quite interesting because if you look at the history of the Afrikaner Broederbond, it was certainly it was regarded as a secret society at some stage. And then in 1993, they say they came out and they decided to become the Afrikaner Bond, as we said. He is very intent in saying we did not engage in state capture and so on. We did not do such things. But history shows that, like we said, all of the prime ministers of South Africa since 1947 until 1994 were members of the Afrikaner Broederbond. Mr. Kortbroek, Martinus van Schalkwyk was also a member, it says. These guys were, through the HNP, the Herenigde Nationale Partij, which had significant political power, they wielded a lot of power. And then the question becomes, is it a coincidence that most of these people that were part of this network somehow just landed their bums in butter?
Listen, if you've just joined the show, we've got off to a rampant start where we're asking, frankly speaking, are the Stellenbosch Mafia the original state capturers? Of course, you can join us on WeChat, cliffcentral.com, or hit us up on Twitter at Talk to Us Frankly, or at Rory Shabalala, or at Yebo_Levy. It is a fascinating conversation. And let me tell you, I didn't know a lot about the Stellenbosch Mafia, but the more research that has gone on, the more this topic is absolutely unbelievable. I just want to read you one thing, Rory, from a very interesting professor named Sampi Terreblanche, noted at the TRC. If one understands the structural nature of South Africa's political and economical system correctly, then it is clear that the one side of South African structured coin impoverished the Africans, while the other side of the same structural coin enriched the whites, especially during the first 70 years of this century. And then Johan Rupert had the audacity to go and actually speak at the TRC and say, we had nothing to do with it. We had nothing to do with it. Max Dupree said this amazing quote where he was like, if you were just a bystander of this conversation where you saw these men in black suits and ties, you would think that they were all anti-apartheid activists instead of capitalists. We're joined by Ralph Matega. He's in the studio today. Ralph, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on your book launch.
Thank you so much.
Very, very successful. We ask you, I mean, do you think that is there a Stellenbosch Mafia? Is this just, are we talking rubbish here? What's going on?
Look, there are historical facts and there are all sorts of conspiracies that I've heard of, and I've read a lot of the history that you're talking about back at university. Actually, I remember some of the authors who have done a great deal of work in identifying or in explaining the relationship that the Afrikaner capital, if you like it, had with the state by then. One of the great writers who have done that was Hemen Khiliomi, one of the professors there who wrote around it. A lot of South African intellectuals have written about this from the Afrikaner side, and also some of the black progressive professors who have written on this. Put aside the conspiracy, the whole story of the Stellenbosch Mafia, Bruder Bond being part of a secret society, part of it is just nonsense. I'll tell you what I mean by that.
That's why we like you, Ralph.
You know, I'll tell you what happened that time, as history tells us. What happened is that there has been a very close relationship between the state and capital under apartheid. And the state actually has made a great deal of concessionary loans involving the formation of some of the successful companies that you see today. Some I don't want to give them free advertisement.
Naspers.
Exactly. Mm. A lot of these companies, a lot of them were started by some of the concession loans that were given by the state. I can even take you to another case about the building of Ellis Park Stadium. The ownership of Citizen newspaper as well. Those are some of the entities that were specifically have had loans from the state under concession. The whole idea of Africana economic development, the unfortunate and abhorrent part of it, of course, is that it was at the expense of development of black people. If it was inclusive, it was a very interesting development project that actually people have thought about even in the post-apartheid South Africa. What has happened by then is that you the state establishes a company, maybe it's as we say. After the state establishes its core, they capitalize it very well. They then let it go to the private sector. That has been the model of development in many areas. Japan, after the war, they followed that under the bank that was very influential called the MITI, Ministry of Trade and International, Industry in Japan. There were cases in China as well that we can talk about where the state actually funded that. So we have had that relationship under apartheid, where the state created a synergy with capital, where actually the thriving of capital under apartheid was was seen as a necessary thing that the state has to support to ensure that the state by then also and the government by then also had legitimacy. There was that symbiotic relationship. And history tells us that towards 1992, at some point, as you read South Africa's transition, is that the regulatory mechanism of apartheid, where it ensured that black people are reserved to the homelands, the whole private sector thing was no longer holding up to a point where the some of the Africana capital actually, some came forth and said that, look, apartheid is not working. We can't grow further. This system, it's not working. That is one of the reasons why when apartheid government under F.W. de Klerk caved in, it was partially not only because of the liberation movement, but also because apartheid capital itself no longer found that economic arrangement viable.
The business model no longer held.
Exactly. You had sanctions and you have exhausted the local market in a sense that you have excluded a large number of people who don't have a buying power. So the whole thing collapsed on its head. But some of the people who began to start ditching apartheid political framework were the Afrikaners by then. Yes. Then came the ANC in 1994. No relationship with any private sector. The ANC has been very suspicious about the private sector in South Africa because the private sector, which played a bigger role in actually undermining the legitimacy of apartheid, now it was there, independent. The ANC came about. One thing the ANC knew for sure, which is a fact, is that the private sector, if it undermines you, especially the powerful private sector that you have, you've got no way to go politically. And that is why my view is that it has been the project of the ANC itself as a party to recapture some of the levers of the state to ensure that the political development that you need, their mandate, it's actually synchronized with control of the economy. The whole idea of capturing the state and so forth, it's a very, very broad issue, no doubt. You can have a very close relationship between the private sector, where the private sector dominates the direction of government and influences the value system within the society without necessarily capturing the state. What is it that we're talking about the state? The courts, the people, civil society, the media. You cannot fully capture all of those under you cannot put them all under the same roof and direct maybe an objective that you need under that. You can capture certain levers of power, the economy. Maybe you can capture capture a political party like the ANC, I believe, is fully captured now. And then there are other entities. For me, it's not the state that is being captured in South Africa. It is the ANC that it cannot even get out of it.
It's done. Ralph, I want us to go back. There's a critical thing that you spoke about here, and I think it's probably at the heart of what we're talking about. That transition where these companies got concessionary loans, What happened after that? How did those companies end up in the hands of a few? And is it the same as the original concept of BEE, where it was only an elite few Afrikaner that made it while the rest didn't? Or was it a more broad-based approach? Is BEE essentially a copy of that? I'm asking you a number of questions, but...
Very good point.
What's going on? What happened to those loans? Were they ever paid back? And how did then... those companies end up in the hands, because some of them were state-owned. How did they end up in the hands of a few?
It has been the traditional trajectory of building the private sector. The state, even today as we speak, the state is the one that is capable of taking the major risk. The state has got guarantees. They've got you and I, taxpayers' money. And that is the reason why in most of the risky greenfield economic project, energy and so forth, the state can put that seed money. But what had happened under apartheid is that it was not broad-based. It was not inclusive. It essentially excluded quite a large number of black people. Some of those loans, that's why we call them concession loans, some were never paid back. And by the way, you might have 10 companies that started by then, but other 80 might have collapsed. We need to do thorough investigation. It doesn't mean anything that was started by the state then worked. It doesn't mean the state was efficient. That's not the case. How does that come into BEE? How can you compare it with BEE, as you are saying? It's a very simple thing. The apartheid government wanted to create a sympathetic private sector. They've done, to a point where that private sector was no longer cooperative to the mandate of apartheid. Under BEE, it is the very same logic as well, where the aim of the ANC-led government in post-apartheid South Africa, as it comes out in their speeches over and over, is to create a sympathetic black elite entrepreneurs, business people who are going to actually understand and sympathize with the very system of the political mandate that is held by the ANC. Quite often within this thing, not all of these projects succeed, because I think that BEE has gained the life of its own and has become a nightmare to the very same ANC. Hence, we are talking about the capturers. There are different types of capturers. There are those who have captured the ANC and they are coming from the ANC itself. There is the private sector generally that have captured the whole sector in South Africa, or the exact influence within the whole sector, actually making the ANC capturers look like people who are picking crumbs and so forth. That is how, for me, the whole thing comes about. The reality is that under any circumstances, this comes down to the relationship between the private sector, the value system of the private sector, and also government. And when you talk about the private sector, you are talking about individual men and women with influence, with a lot of money, who wants to accumulate more and more.
This is very interesting. This is, I feel like we have to take a breath quickly, because we all want to speak right at the same time. Ralph Motshekga is joining us in studio. Of course, he is an incredible analyst and a good friend of the show. Can we say good friend, or have you then captured us?
No, I'm just wondering.
I just want to know.
Because you never know how I'm even going to respond to a question. That cannot be a capture. It's a natural relationship.
Now, that's interesting, because I wanted to bring up this idea of capitalism as a code within South Africa.
Yeah.
We're in a capitalistic state.
Yes.
Therefore, there must be a relationship between government and the private sector.
Yes.
When is it healthy, and when do we start asking questions?
Good point. There is nothing wrong with people within the private sector trying to influence the direction of government. I can put it on record, there is nothing wrong. But your question is you're asking, when is it fair and open? In the US, for example, I'll give you an example. The elections that I've observed closely, resulting in Donald Trump being elected. I've observed the US elections a few times. In the US, it's an open space. What happened is that a company, GlaxoSmithKline, which manufactures medication, drugs, they say that Andrew is running for presidency. We will put $3 billion to support you. You know what that means? What that means is very clear. When people are looking at you, they are knowing that you are likely to be a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical companies. The information is clear in the open. The problem with what is happening in South Africa is that it is becoming clandestine. It's not our political system does not actually appreciate lobbyism. That is why you actually don't know what is the intention of the people. You don't even know who fund which political party in South Africa, because political parties, this is where the DA agrees very well with the ANC. They refuse
to divulge
who's there's no honor among thieves. Probably that's what maybe I don't know. So for me, the critical part is that In South Africa, we have got an unrealistic moral basis for our politics. We tend to assume that these are great men and women who are always doing it well for us and everything. Whereas in the US, there is a concern. People are open. People are saying that, look, I took money from Coca-Cola to run for elections and all. And when you are elected, we know we're dealing with someone who's going to be soft on Coke. So when we talk to you, we have clear expectation. Let's put it out in the open. Who is trying to influence who? So that civil society organization and generally the people can be able to be to access this information and have a better relationship with politicians and decision makers.
Ralph, it's interesting you speak about these the US setup. There's an interesting conversation happening in US, and I know we're a bit off topic, but where Donald Trump is even saying he's not going to stop his business dealings. Is that the level of transparency? I mean, it's a literal conversation. He's saying, normally you do blind trust, arm's length, and he has said, not necessarily so, and there's actually no laws that specifically prohibit him.
You know, there's so much lying and dishonesty in Washington, where some people try to lie. Of course, there's a great deal of transparency. You know, one thing I like about Donald Trump is what you see is what you get. Mm. You know, there's no pretense. There's no diplomacy about the whole thing. He's going to build a wall. He's not going to tell you that, look, we're going to make sure that there are holes on the wall so you can peep the other side. No, it's a wall that's going to stand like that. Yeah. You're not going to see
like
anything.
You like it, you don't like it.
You like it, you don't like it. It's not a half wall with a bit of a wind flow and all that.
Yes.
And I think that one of the reasons why Donald Trump is taking it to the corporations and also saying that, you know what, this blind trust lie thing, I'm not going to be part of it, is because he used this money to campaign.
Mm. This is the person. He doesn't owe anyone anything.
It's just that his ideas are crazy and he's mean sometimes. But when it comes to the independence of thinking, this is the man who didn't come through Washington. That is why I think his victory for me, as I look at it, I don't want to be biased. It's a victory against the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yes.
He won against both parties.
Well, let's come back. Let's come back to our topic and let's come back to South Africa. It sounds to me we've gone to the United States. We've gone into the ANC. We've gone into the DA. It sounds like they're all the same. So is the state capture thing even a legitimate issue that we should be tearing our hair out about?
Do we just assume that state capture happens?
If it already exists, why is there such a big hullabaloo? Is it that the wrong people are now too close to power? But generally, the principle of state capture is not seen as a big deal.
Let's begin with practical ways to deal with this, which is the party capture. Who sponsored the DA? Who sponsors the ANC? Mm. And what if these people are being sponsored by the same people financially, and we all go around in the as if we are choosing from one party to another, whereas it's the same people. We don't have that information. And I think for me, the heart of your question is also that, are we having a good debate or are we having a debate that is being managed by a politician? My fear is that the debate is being managed by a politician. Remember, if the truth were to come out as to who fund who, you will start realizing the extent of similarities and synergy within these political parties. And that actually will be a big betrayal to the voters. So I don't have a problem with this debate. Let the people talk and all. But my concern is if the debate is being hijacked or captured by political parties themselves. Mm. I don't trust political parties. I don't trust people who don't want to tell them where they get their money. And I don't even trust the manner in which they've cohered in hiding that information.
All of a sudden,
it's just amazing. Yeah. It shows that the logic of politicians is to maximize elections. We should treat them with doubt. Hence, the manner in which they have come into this debate of state capture, taking it from this and that, they will make sure that at the end of the day, it protects the integrity of their of their organization, which I think we need to interrogate, because it starts with the parties. It starts with the question, who fund them? Maybe this mafia that is being talked about has been channeling money to the DA and the ANC. Let them release their books, and then we can now take them seriously about this debate.
Well, we're speaking about the mafia. Let's just name these people so we know who we're talking about. We've got
allegedly just so we don't get sued.
we don't get a meeting request a little later, right? So allegedly the people in the Stellenbosch mafia: Johan Rupert, Yanni Mouton, Christo Visser, Koos Becker, GT Ferreira, Marcus Uster, and Michel Leroux or Michael Leroux, I don't know how you pronounce that.
Who are among some of them, right?
That's not all of them. Just to give you an idea, these are heads of companies like Remgro, who has a market cap of 116 billion, PSG 47 billion, ShopRite 111 billion, Naspers 959 billion. That's 36% of the JSE market cap. First Rand 296 billion, Steinhoff 295 billion, Capitec, who's recently new to the market, 78.5 million. We talk about mafia guys, right, Rory? And Johan Rupert's name comes up again and again. I just want you to listen to this clip of Johan Rupert. I've never heard him speak until this point. You know, you hear of this man and what he's done. Just have a listen to this. Make up your own mind whether you think this guy's part of the
mafia. It's interesting when you speak about relationships with different parties. This one is an interesting relationship.
Because if it hadn't been for his narratives, I was in danger of becoming totally irrelevant. I mean, you guys have forgotten about us. Firstly, I don't live in Stellenbosch. I don't know I can be part of the Stellenbosch Mafia. We live in Somerset West. And I haven't been given an award for so long until Mr. Malema arrived. And he pointed out to me that I was running the ANC, the DA, the SARS, by the way, like El SARS. They only give me trouble, especially recently, by the way. The kind of, you want to talk against us? And I forgot the central bank, they were in as well. And now, of course, people have left him, and they now say, I'm controlling Julius. I've never met him. But I did send him a text message through a friend that if he doesn't stop lying about me, I'm going to tell the world that I actually do give him money. All I have to do is to put the little text out and then make it look like it was an accidental direct message that... and lie. All I have to say is, I've met you, I like you, and I'm actually backing you. So stop lying about me, and I won't lie about our relationship. I've never met you, but I promise you, two can play the game.
There you go, two can play the game. So... we've got these guys. I mean, he sounds like a mafioso.
I don't know, man.
He sounds like a very polite mafioso. I'm telling you, this guy is as hectic as they get.
He's like Kaiser Soze. You know, the character in the movie, you know, suspect. He doesn't exist. He exists. Nobody has seen him.
Yes, yes. But there you go. And he's couching it in very joking terms. But there are a few sort of strong punches there about... you know, I'm accused that I've captured the ANC, the DA, the EFF, and maybe he might, right? And maybe not directly, but through a network of things. Now, one thing that has come out, though, is there was this big uproar that ever since the EFF went to London, when they came back, all of this started. They started harping on about the Stellenbosch Mafia. They started harping on about Johan Rupert and so on, or at least their volume on this issue became louder. Mm. Is there any merit in those sorts of conspiracy theories around the London agenda now and the EFF potentially being captured?
I'm imagining, for what purpose will anyone want to capture the EFF? I mean, what would you want to achieve? To disrupt order or whatever it is?
We can see what card you're carrying now. They're going to be the future presidents of our nation.
But they have defeated, they have managed to ensure that the ANC stays out of the halls of power in the major metros.
The problem, I mean, let's wait. Maybe Mr. Rupert will give us details as to whether he funded them or not. But the thing with the EFF, if you look at them, the EFF are actually saying nothing in South Africa works. They hate the private sector, and for them we must just close shop the private sector, and the state must be responsible for any distribution of opportunities within the economy. That's what they want. So that's why I don't know who would maybe put money to the EFF in London as well. I've listened to what Malema said in London and so forth. I I don't know. I want to assume he's genuine in his criticism of the private sector. I want to assume that he's not someone who could be available to be influenced financially that way. Maybe the likes of Rupert indeed they need to tell us that maybe Rupert will have to say that no, I did not only capture the ANC, I've captured the DA. It's equal capturing. Yes. Everybody else is captured in the same measure, if that is the
some
case.
More equal than others. I'm feeling something going on here. Listen, I wanted to read you guys, if you'll allow me, the testimony from Johann Rupert during the TRC. Now, just take us back for a second. This is late 90s. We've just hit democracy. We're going through some transitional. The TRC is this incredible moment of where the perpetrators, the extremists come through. Johann Rupert asks to speak at the TRC. And he says, I'm just, the entire speech is fascinating, but I'm just giving you a little paragraph. He's like, "Now, I'm immensely proud of those achievements." He's talking about his business. "It shows that we could have achieved by a few people from the southern tip of Africa who believed in miracles and set out to make them happen. However, for over 40 years in South Africa, we've operated in an unjust society. I think the first question we must ask is, did the private sector benefit from this unjust and inhumane society of social engineering? And I think that's an in brackets, unclear point. I'm not going to debate it. I think that's a debate that can be held over weeks. Certainly, if that had to be the case, it is very interesting that we had a total unique situation where business in South Africa was to the left of government. Now, maybe not far enough to the left. Certainly, retrospectively, it wasn't too far. But I cannot recall of a single government abroad in every bit of economic and political history that I've read that had to contend with businessmen that actually criticized them from the left." So he's actively saying that he was on the left. He was criticizing the apartheid government. And there's this huge, you know, you talk about conspiracies, Ralph, and I think there's so many in South Africa. We could do movies for days on these conspiracies, where the apartheid government, through big business, siphoned, at the end of apartheid, siphoned a whole bunch of money through these big businesses. Any thoughts on that?
Exactly. There has been illicit transactions towards the end of apartheid around 1992 or so. A report has been done. I remember one of the colleagues I used to work with, Henny van Vieren. His career has been an obsession about this, and he has done an incredible job on some of these transactions that have been talked about. Andile Mjitama, actually, in his case to the public protector, former public protector, was that we need to recover that money that actually left South Africa in an illicit way towards the massive looting that has actually taken place.
26 billion.
Yeah, that's quite. And if you put it in today's value, you're talking about maybe a trillion, if you like, that amount of money cash that left the country. But I think there is an interesting question that Mr. Rupert is saying there about whether the private sector gained from apartheid. It did gain. The law ensured, apartheid law through the demarcation, the whole thing of the urban periphery control laws, ensured that there is cheap black labor available for apartheid system, the manner in which it has started. This is the same thing as asking if China's industry has benefited from cheap labor. It did, no doubt. China is extremely competitive now where we are because of being able to develop very well under cheap labor. It is the same argument that has been made today by some free market entrepreneurs who are actually saying that too much legislation on the labor minimum wage and all that will actually kill small companies and so forth. Mm. These arguments keep on being made and being made. But we also need to note as well that in economics, when you grow to a certain point, you outgrow the system that has created you. What has happened with apartheid capital and the private sector is that it has grown that condition that created. It needed to blossom outside, but then you had sanction. You had that. That is why those guys started saying, giving apartheid administration a hard time, that guys, this can't we come up with reforms? We cannot access the market outside. And also this thing of a cheap labor of yours, it just doesn't work. Even today as we speak, our economy is retarded by that creation of cheap labor because majority of black people are still not integrated into the mainstream economy. So apartheid capital gained traction, avoided risk because of the legislative framework under government.
You know, guys, I want to ask you a question about this whole thing because this is, again, based in a capitalistic society, right? With the added avenue of apartheid, which then helped benefit white capitalist monopoly, right? And we talk about the Stellenbosch Mafia, and I suppose some people, specifically white people, can get their backs up because like, oh, this is white monopoly capital. I'm not part of it. I'm not that Rupert guy. There is something to be said about that, which is to say, do these guys have more of a responsibility? than the average white person to right the wrongs of the past?
I think partially it's also the same question you can ask. I mean, I remember one day taking a bus with someone who was a white person who was very angry with Julius and said to me that, yeah, you know, Ralph, you must deal with that. And I said that, well, suppose I agree with you that Julius is wrong on everything. Why is it my responsibility to correct the crazy things in our society? Why are you even associating myself with him? But I understood where the guy came from, because that apartheid capital used the African identity as a way to, because each and every society, when it develops, capitalism takes a different form. It can take a different culture. In the US, in Japan, it can take that culture, and it has to be infused in a local culture so that you can accumulate in a way that does not necessarily radically disturb the social fabric of the society. So the whole idea of the survival of Afrikaners, Christianity, Calvinism, you know, that has been one of the biggest motivation for rapid accumulation and for working hard. That's how you get people to work 15 hours. They don't think that they are being working like machines to accumulate. What they are thinking is that they are working in the survival of the Afrikaner dom. Afrikaner, that is the same thing. The same thing applies to black economic empowerment, where people are saying that it's not just accumulation, it's about ensuring the value system of building an inclusive economy for blacks. Does what is my view about that as a black person? Why do I have to respond to that? These are some of the difficult questions that we need to look at about the relationship between culture and economics.
Ralph, there's also the conversation about black people, and increasingly the Stellenbosch Mafia is becoming more diverse, it sounds like. Names like Jane Aidoo get called up when
KK Kombi.
I haven't received my invite, if I have to say. I'll be checking the mailbox. Yeah.
It raises the question, why? So what is it now with these black? So there are transactions. There's Pembani, which has which concluded transactions with Remgro. With Johan Rupert's company, what's happening now? Is there really, because now it's a myth, the Stellenbosch Mafia thing is a myth, but is there really an organized, or is it just business people who by coincidence happen to come from a certain part of this country?
A small town.
A very small, quaint town. By coincidence, they all just happen to know each other, and this has happened and transpired. They own close to 50% of the JSE market cap, if not more. It's almost unbelievable that such coincidences happen. What's going on?
You know what? I usually try to set myths aside, because usually the nations invent myths just because they cannot own up to their history. To own up to what has happened to the history of South Africa is that Afrikaners have been very effective in dealing with poverty within African communities. They've done it. The post office system that we have today has largely benefited a lot. It was a sector that was put aside to deal with poor whites' problem. The same thing with the railway industry. You need to go back to the economic history of this country. So they've been able to deal with those issues and so forth. The main problem was that at some point, some of the goals that were achieved under that structure were achieved at the expense of black people. So the question that I think people are willing to ask now, and I think that if you look at a lot of people making some work and research on political economy of post-apartheid South Africa, there are people who have honestly said, what can we learn from the mobilization capacity of the Afrikaner capital back then? What is it that, what value system can we really bring now? And some of these transactions that you see now, there is a possibility that some of the BEE people are actually willing to learn on how some Afrikaners did it. Of course, I don't think they will then feather the whole thing of racial exclusion. It might be class, the form of exclusion, that might be a necessary path towards that development. But there is nothing wrong in people coming, some people within the BEE saying that, look, we need to look into the instruments of Afrikanerdom and to see how they did it, minus the whole thing of racism and exclusion. But there is something to look at. And by the way, that part of Afrikaner development, it is part of history. It even affects black people. Why is it that if black people maybe feel that they need to rewrite development, why can't they tap into that, even that painful part of their history, which they have enjoyed anyway? Why can't you tap into what you have enjoyed as a nation? I don't see anything fundamentally wrong for that.
So are the Guptas being picked on then? In the final analysis, what I'm hearing is that state capture happens, has been happening, and in the Afrikaner communities was used particularly effectively to lift the Afrikaner community from the post-Boer War situation, which was dire, and created a few billionaires and so on. And out of that, a lot can still happen. The Guptas, are they being picked on, and is it really a big deal?
It is a big deal, because the problem is that their methods are crass, and the method actually raises serious legitimacy problems with the BEE. Fundamentally, there is nothing wrong with BEE. It's the manner in which it is being implemented. It is an ANC project, and I think the ANC should have safeguards. But the Gupta situation shows that the ANC lost safeguard mechanism on the BEE, where the Guptas came and said to themselves they are a better partner and engage in this kind of a crass transactions that lacked any moral basis for that matter. That is where the problem is. But I also think here, the funny part that I think, you know, when I'm sitting at home thinking about these guys, I look in the sky and say that, you know, this debate, how it has come about, is like some ANC members have made maybe 100 million and they wake up, realize the Guptas have made 6 billion and they went bonkers. Like, oh God, these guys have made so much. It's not about principle, it's
jealousy amongst the elite.
It's about, you thought that the bribery you got was good, and you start realizing that Ralph has received four times that, and you start having a sense of injustice about that. You want to actually democratize corruption.
I'm interested in this whole debate, and it's very, very interesting you bring up elitism, Rory. Ralph's cheeks just lit up when he said that, didn't he?
I mean, you know what President Jacob Zuma says to people? That, hey, look, guys, don't forget, you've got your peace. The fact that you negotiated for a small peace is none of our business. That's what he means when he's talking about all these skeletons. So I look at people desperately wanting to shout at him, and I can see their body language saying that, but they're going to talk about that 2 million of mine.
Is this the veterans? Is this what happened to the veterans? Because the veterans went in gung-ho, they came out like...
Probably the president just said to them, "These are the can we have a beginning pack for this meeting? Can we look through that for 5 minutes before we talk later?"
They said, no, we understand,
but please, man, stop attacking us in the public. Tell Mr. Kevin Mopate to chill, because we can't... Because, you know what, we're talking about the system, a very corrupted political system. It's not about individuals. Individuals come and go. The system itself is corrupt.
But that's interesting that you bring that up, because, you know, you've said a few times throughout this conversation that we should look at the Afrikanerdom and the positives of it and try and use that. But that is based on elitism. It's based on exclusivity. Yes. There were 10 families that lived in the Stellenbosch region that went to the same school, that went to the same university.
Yes.
And now you look at, Rory, you've got the stats there of the boards, and you look at who sits on the boards and who owns a percentage of what. It's unbelievable. PSG owns Rembrandt 20%. This one owns Mouton, Steinhoff owns this. It's ridiculous.
I remember when I was at university, one of my professors used to talk about this thing of capitalism with a human face. That's what we are doing now. What we are doing now with the Guptas and everyone. It's not necessarily to defeat the entire capitalist. It reinvents itself. It survives better. It has survived since Marx wrote Capital, for that matter.
Yes.
It has evolved over a period of time. So what we are doing now is to say to guys that, please, guys, just slow down a little bit so that there is some to build those houses along Deep Sloot and along Jokskay River in Alex.
Don't kill the goose.
That's just busy, the whole point.
They're killing the goose. That's the problem.
It's more like saying to them that, look, government is not shutting down next week, guys. You can't just
you can
take
slow
so
down,
much.
Yeah.
Slow down a little bit here. What's wrong with you?
Well, Ralph is coming alive, and unfortunately,
it's
at
like
this
a
very
comedian
moment,
right now,
and
like,
now he
like
has to leave.
I'll be back, guys. I'll be back. We can talk about this even further. I still have points.
No. We really want to get those points, Ralph Matekha of Mistra. Thank you so much for joining us. Useful insights. I still wanted to find out what you think of Jan Bosman earlier and some of the things he said.
He lives in his own world. That's fine. He can live in that. That's the beauty of a post-apartheid South Africa. You can just live
it's
in your own
world.
Just like President Jacob Zuma lives in his. Everybody has their own
Ralph,
little world.
Ralph, get out of here before you get yourself into trouble.
He's
having too much fun.
Wow, Ralph Matekha, thank you so much for... I thought he was an economic analyst and political analyst, but actually I've realized that he is a... full-on stand-up comedian, hilarious Ralph Matekha. Thank you for joining us. Rory, that leaves you and I talking about this And I feel like this topic is so broad that we might have gone a little bit all over the place, to be honest. Even though fascinating as it is, we've spoken about quite a bit here.
Understandably so. I think this is an issue that we needed to first understand, and it's quite broad by the sounds of things. I think some of the things we didn't have enough time, for example, with Jan Bosman, some of the things that he said just sounded like complete inaccuracies and lies. So I think that there's something to be... Those are some of the things that we need to tackle. The fact that Iscor and all of those companies, the ABSAs of this world, were formed by members of the Afrikaner Broederbond. So... We have to engage those more deeply. We have to engage some of the things that Ralph has spoken about. Ralph's book, by the way, When Zuma Goes, also has some interesting points that need to be brought in to the conversation. Now, Ralph has decided to come back because he's having too much fun.
I
think those are the sorts of things that we need to unpack and go into in greater detail.
I wonder, the interesting thought that has been playing on my mind throughout this conversation is this idea of networks and social capital. We've spoken about that's one of the big issues amongst the haves and the have-nots in this country is what they call social capital. The idea that you don't have an uncle or a father's friend who works at that company who can give you the internship, the spare laptop, the cell phone, the money to go to varsity, so on and so on and so on, right? This is like social capital on steroids.
But it's also, I think...
GT Ferreira giving 100 million to this one to
invest
in this thing.
But we need to ask ourselves again, where is the wrong, right? So, and maybe the wrong is when it is to the exclusion of others.
Here comes the capitalist, Ronnie Sang Shabalala, former politician.
No, Chief, but you need to understand. I think the question is when it is to the exclusion. That is what I heard Ralph saying, to say, look... The project, the Afrikaner project of developing the Afrikaner community post the Boer War, was successful in many ways. There are a lot of things that can be learned from that, in terms of just how you develop communities and society. The biggest problem with that was it was to the exclusion and to the exploitation of the black masses in this country. If we can take from that and we can use that and tap into it, as I think Ralph is saying, is that tap into what exists and make sure that we open it up so that more people can benefit, so that it's not just a closed network. That is probably in the hands of you and me. Andrew, you know a couple of people who would be associated with white monopoly capital. You should be integrating Bula and so on into those networks.
No,
that's how me and you.
We are not externalizing.
What I'm saying is we can externalize it and say Rupert and say all of those people, but you and me have the power as young professionals and so on who operate in some of these networks, who have a little bit, we have the power. We have the power within the communities. One of the things that Jan said earlier was that, no, we work on membership fees and so on, which half truth, right? But it is true that if you can aggregate the amount of money that you and me and a number of young professionals earn and so on, and we begin to invest in one another, those are the ways in which we can begin to reverse some of the apartheid injustices.
I think there's a fascinating conversation here about inclusion versus exclusion, and I think that's definitely something that's come to my mind. Let's go back a little bit. We talk about the Stellenbosch Mafia, and are they the state capturers? When we talk about mafia, we have very negative connotations, of course. When we talk about state capture, we all think Gupta, we all think negative, we all think illegal. The things that we're speaking about, social capital and networking and keeping it exclusive instead of inclusive, that doesn't necessarily mean illegal, right? So what part of the Stellenbosch Mafia, that, you know, the alleged Stellenbosch Mafia, are we currently uncomfortable with? So for me, there's two parts, right? The first part is to say these guys definitely benefited. The companies that were formed, the people that played, definitely benefited from the apartheid system, unjustly. What have they done? Naspers wrote a letter saying, we apologize. They own 969 billion rand market cap. Is writing a letter really what they should be doing?
Yeah, and if you listen to the concessionary loans and so on, that was state money that they have the capacity to pay back right now. And to what extent are they paying it back? I think it's pay back the money needs to be expanded. It's gone to Zuma. Zuma has now paid back the money. Maybe we need to now turn to these companies, the likes of Naspers, even the ABSAs and so on, and say, so when are you paying back the money?
You see, the problem, I think, Rory, is capitalism as a structure lends itself to this kind of capturing in a gray area. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, I give you a loan, or I fund your political party, or I do this.
You just have beef with capitalism. I don't think there's anything wrong with capitalism. I think the way, in as much as socialism and communism have been used as oppressive systems as well. The issue is not the economic system.
But it is.
No,
it
is. I refuse.
Let me tell you why. Because the economic system allows for power, which then drives political agendas.
But that is the law of the jungle. So
then there's no state capturing then.
No, if you can create a system in which... But the issue of capitalism is not the system itself, in my view. The issue around capitalism is the way in which it excludes others from the opportunities that capitalism affords all of us. Communism is much... You know, you have communist states where there's some people who live much better than the rest. Mm. How does that happen? Mm-mm. So the system is a problem.
Thank you. You've agreed with me. The system is a problem. I appreciate
communism
that.
Is a system. Capitalism is a system. All these systems are a problem. Actually, people are a problem. Let's just get out of here.
Right,
I'm
sick and tired of people. Frankly speaking, were the Stellenbosch Mafia the original state capturers? I think there's more to be said about this. We've started with it. Thank you to Ralph Matecha and also Jan Bosman. He's the head of the Broederbond. I don't even know how you justify that organization existing right now.
Leave him alone.
But if you want to hear more, cliffcentral.com/frankly speaking. Yo, these conversations are heating up.
Jovi,
Rory. Bye-bye. Cliffcentral.com.